Hello and welcome once again to Core Ideas, a paleolimnology podcast. As usual, I am one of your co-hosts, Adam Jeziorski, joined as always by
Josh Thienpont. Thanks for coming back again.
All right. And so today's episode, we're continuing to round out our kind of series on fundamentals. And today we're going to be talking about physical and chemical indicators within the sediment. So contrasting strongly with episode 2, where we're talking about the biological remains in the sediments, here we're talking about various chemical signatures and physical properties of the sediment itself that can be used to infer long-term environmental change.
Yeah, exactly. The topic of today is going to be a little bit more, where we'll spend a little bit less time on each thing. There's a lot of things we want to cover, and it's going to link a little bit between really all of the episodes. We're going to contrast, as Adam said, with episode 2 when we were talking about biological indicators, though there are some things that we intentionally left out of that episode that fit a little better here. We're going to talk a little bit about isotopes, which contrasts with episode 3 on radioisotopes and dating. And then everything is linked to taking the sediment cores. But one of the things we often think about quickly after retrieving one of these sediment cores is the physical makeup of that sediment. So that'll be the first thing we talk about. So it's going to link all of those together and hopefully provide some of that stuff that may not be as familiar with some of the people listening, because there's a lot of different physical and chemical properties of sediment that can be analyzed. And this is going to be a little sampling of all of them.
And a key thing to keep in mind is, as always, we keep harping on about you have to tailor your study to the questions you're trying to answer, because, you know, the simple fact of the matter is you can't do everything. There's going to be a limited amount of sediment available. Some of these methods are destructive, i.e. they use up some of the sediment to get the measurements that you're looking for. So in any given interval, you're going to have to pick and choose how you're going to allocate your sediment, depending on what it is you're actually trying to find out about the lake and the watershed in question.
Yeah, that's a great point. Some of these methods are very sediment intensive, in addition to being, especially some of the chemical methods, in addition to being destructive. And one of the whole things about starting your paleolimnological analysis is thinking about the order in which you would undertake some of these analyses, because some of the later chemical ones we'll talk about requires knowing something about the sediment in terms of the organic carbon content of the sediment. So that would be something you would obviously want to do first. But you, in that same interval, you may need to date that interval. You may be looking at biological indicators. You may be collaborating with someone who is going to be doing all sorts of different analyses. So putting this all together on paper before you actually start getting into any of these bags of sediment, if they've been discreetly broken up, is a critical first step to really think about before you start destroying mud, when maybe some of these analyses could be done all in a non-destructive technique and then move on to those.
Absolutely. And the analyses really begin on a, I guess, superficial level, you know, pun intended, would be the second that you take the core or retrieve the core out of the water, because straight away you're going to be looking at it. You're going to be looking for very obvious color changes or texture changes within the core profile. So like a classic one I remember being pointed out very, very early on was collecting cores in Muskoka. That area was clear cut in the mid to late 1800s, and looking for a general color change that was visible to the naked eye 10, 15 centimeters down the core, just to get a rough idea of, is my core long enough to address what I'm looking at? Similarly, if you pull up the core and see alternating layers of light and dark, it's like, oh, we got varves here. All of a sudden, our dating became a lot easier.
Yeah, or some sort of lamination for sure. Yeah, which can tell you, even if they're not varved, about the environment that they're being deposited in. Absolutely.
You know, and again, I've never encountered this, but you know, if you're in an area of volcanic activity, you might be able to see a ash layer very visibly in the core as well. And so what you'll be doing as you're pulling the cores out is taking pictures of them. If you're working with like a piston core type sediment, you'll also be doing some like visual to see, looking to see whether you potentially overlap, or also keep a record of top versus bottom. So when you ship them all back to the lab intact, you know, having a good idea of what the actual order was.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, that's a really key point. So the first thing we'll talk about as we get into some of these physical and chemical indicators is analyses that can be done on cores when they're whole. But if you're sectioning the core, especially if it's a gravity core, at the lakeside or very soon after, you're never going to see it back together again once you've taken and sectioned and extruded it into discrete intervals. So this is the time to take those pictures, take those notes and write them down in your notebook just before you're ready to section those, because you'll never really get them back together again. And that's the last time you'll be able to see that full core profile if you section it right away.
Moving on. So if you don't section it right away, one of the key, I guess, technological ways that you'd be beginning your analysis would be whole core scanning. And so this is when you're using instrumentation to measure what you can't see visually. And so there are very expensive pieces of equipment that are, you know, specially made for dealing with full cores, or I guess split cores, so like half a core, so you'd have a flat surface. And I'm sure there are more models and companies out there, but the one that I'm most familiar with, and the limited amount that I am familiar with it, would be iTrack scanners, which might be familiar to some of the people listening to this. And so this is the kind of thing that you can be using to do a general measurement of metals within your core using techniques such as X-ray. Fluorescence would be one of the scans that would be possible with this kind of machine.
Yeah, I think the specific profile of scans that are done on and cores depends on the model of any of the units, depending not just whether it's an iTrax versus another company, but which model you buy. But the idea being that you can scan the entire core length after it's been split in half. These are, again, generally done with cores that are of a thicker composition that don't fall apart like a gravity core would. And that allows you to get, the nice thing about that is, unlike the finest sort of sectioning you're going to do with a gravity core into discrete intervals would probably be a quarter of a centimeter of mud, which is a fairly small interval. The full core scanning technology allows you to be much more fine resolution than that. You can scan at higher resolution, might be a tenth, you know, might be a millimeter resolution that the scanner device looks at. So you can look at higher resolution than would be in interval that you've already sectioned into different discrete levels. And on top of that, it can scan multiple things at once. So it can be really, really quickly. So the device may be using X-ray fluorescence to scan for different metal compositions in the sediments. It may also be at the same time optically visualizing it, so taking RGB photos of that. It may be calculating the magnetic susceptibility at the same time. And there, it's all done in a single pass of the machine. So you get lots and lots of data really, really quickly. And that's a in addition to being able to do this at really high resolution and having some interesting analyses, it can be done really quickly. And then on top of that, it's a non-destructive technique. So the core is whole and you have all of that sediment available again after that analysis has been done, which may not be the case if you were to send samples away for metals analysis, for example, on discrete intervals.
Yeah, because these machines, you would have like put the whole half core down directly onto it and covered it with like a saran wrap or plastic layer. So the actual sediment is not being touched in any way. You're just basically doing a, I guess not indirect's not the word, but.
Yeah, it's like a passover kind of analysis. Yep.
Yep.
And I guess the other thing to add on that is this is one technology that can be done, but there are other things that can be done on whole cores. You can take a core and put it in an X-ray machine or an MRI. There are people who take these down to the hospital on near to the university campuses and put cores into medical imaging devices. in order to get data. It's not done all the time, but for certain applications, if you want a magnetic resonance image of a sediment core, that can in theory be done. So there are lots of ways to image the full core before you then break it apart.
And a key thing of these kind of scanning approaches is they potentially also just do the volume of data on a bunch of different proxies, would potentially allow you to match cores, whether you're talking about in a piston core scenario where you have overlapping sections or multiple cores from the same basin, again, due to difference in compaction and how close they are together. They're not going to line up perfectly. There's going to be an element of like statistical analysis and wiggle matching, but these are the kind of things that will give you a full profile of data to do that kind of analysis on. So the next step after you've completed all of the analyses that you can do, or not that you can do, but that you're planning to do with the full cores, the next step is working on individual intervals or slices through time. And these approaches are all going to be, is where you're going to get into more involved chemical analyses or procedures. And basically it can be, or at least today we're going to talk about three broad categories of these kind of analyses. We're going to talking about inorganic geochemical methods, with stuff like grain size, LOI, we'll get into that in a second, general stable isotope techniques of carbon, nitrogen, oxygen, and then finally touching very briefly on some of the organic chemical techniques that can be used.
Yeah, and we'll try to keep them broken apart into those categories, but there's some that just for the description and linkages, may kind of methods that cross the boundary between those. So we'll identify what those are as we go through them. But the first thing we want to talk about is grain size analysis. And that's an inorganic technique, obviously. We're thinking about the nature of the sediment. It's almost not really a geochemical technique. It's more of a descriptive technique, but it does have a kind of procedural component to it. So you don't just look at the material and say what it is. There's an analysis component. And it's as straightforward as determining the particle size distribution of that sediment in the interval that you're talking about. So you would integrate that sediment so that you're not taking a little bit out of the bag that might be kind of from one part of the core. You want to get a good homogenized sample, which you would for all of these analyses. If you've broken them into a bag, you want whatever you're going to say the value of that indicator is to be representative of the entire bag, not one tiny little corner of it. So you want to homogenize the sediments well in order to make sure that you're talking about the whole interval. And then for grain size or particle size analysis, you would use a variety of different techniques. Generally, it's through some sort of laser scanner to remove all the organic material because you want to look at the inorganic sediment material. And then calculate the grain size, the size class of a small sample of that to be representative of the bag. And generally it gives you an idea of how much of the sediment is in the clay fraction, how much is in the silty fraction, how much is coarser grain size in the sand fraction. And you can do all different things. You can look at the proportion of each of those classes. You can look at the mean grain size through the entire interval. Just give you some idea of how large the sediment pieces themselves, the inorganic sediment pieces themselves are in that interval, and how those change can tell you about changing environmental conditions. Generally, more energy is required to deposit larger grains, and that means that if you have more sand, you probably had a more energetic environment. If you have more clays and silts, you may have had a more kind of lower energy depositional environment.
And like big changes within them would indicate, you know, big flood events or something like that. So if all of a sudden, if you have a fairly steady grain size profile and whatever the distribution is between clay, silt, and sand, then all of a sudden there's a big change and there's a huge amount more sand, you know, that kind of thing that would indicate is that there was some sort of big inundation, whether it was a mega storm, mega flood,
or a river,
erosion, yep. something was different that all of a sudden compared to the last couple of years, decades, centuries, millennia, whatever it is, something changed that was able to bring a whole bunch of material that took a whole lot more energy than the lake was normally experiencing to get it in there.
Yep, exactly. And then moving on to thinking about other inorganic geochemical techniques, a really common analysis is to look at the proportion of the sediment that is organic and then the proportion that's carbonate-based inorganic material, and then the portion that's silicate. And together, these are referred to as the loss on ignition method. And that's because the way in which you calculate this is to get rid of the things before that in terms of their temperature that they are ignited and combust at.
Yeah. And so this is done in a fairly sequential order. So begins very simply. Like the first step in this process is you basically dry the sediments just to remove any water. Again, this will change through time. The sediments near the surface or the sediment water interface is going to be a lot more watery than the sediment further down. But so you kind of look at that by basically drying the sediments, probably doing this at like on the order of like, 80 degrees Celsius. You're just drying it off in a fairly simple oven.
They could be freeze dried as well.
And then going further from there, the next step is looking at the organic matter present. So basically we're now moving from a drying oven to an actual muffle furnace. So you'd be putting your samples in for some interval of time at 550 degrees Celsius, be like the standard, like this in the actual methodological procedures may vary a little bit, but generally we're talking something in order of 550. So where you're burning off, literally burning off the organic matter. So this would be an example we were talking earlier about destructive techniques, because once you've combusted this material, you're never getting it back. So you, and then you weigh your sample again. So you would have weighed your sample initially, weighed it after drying it to see how much you lost in terms of water, weighed again and to figure out how much you lost in terms of organic matter. And then go, so you've done this at 550 degrees, then you bump it up to 1,000 degrees. And at that point, you're burning off the carbonate material and being left with just basically the inorganic or siliciclastic mineral materials that were left in the sediment. So you'd have your general fractionation between those categories done in the sequential loss on ignition approach.
Yeah, exactly. And it's assumed that at the end, everything that's left over is that silicate minerals and things that are very, very resistant to high temperatures. And that can be a really useful technique. And one of the nice things about LOI is it can be done, even though it is destructive, it doesn't use a ton of sediment, and it can be done quite rapidly. You can fill a muffle furnace with 40 or 50 crucibles and calculate a number of intervals quite quickly in, you know, the order of a day, probably between all of the heating and weighing and that kind of thing, a day to a day and a half to do a decent number of samples. So that's a really powerful technique.
I'll just point out just anecdotally, muffle furnaces really vary in terms of capacity. I've seen ones where you can only maybe do like 10 samples in a shot.
You need a bigger muffle furnace if that's the case.
And ones where you do more like 100 samples at a shot.
Yeah, for sure. That is true. The average kind of size that I've seen in labs, kind of paleolimnology labs, probably are in that 40 to 50 range. Would you say that is a reasonable kind of number?
Yeah, I guess. I'm not seeing a huge number. Just, I think, 3 total is what I've actually opened the door of.
I think we have 3 on. I think there's 2 in our department.
La-di-da.
Geographers. And then I guess a really good segue to that is one of the things about LOI is that often the value we're really interested in is the percent organic matter, because we want to know how organic the sediment is versus how inorganic it is. But the thing about LOI is that the majority of that organic matter is going to be assumed to be carbon, and the remainder being organic nitrogen. And then after that, phosphorus being the least of the big 3 kind of macronutrient sort of organic compounds. But you never know how much that is, because you're just getting rid of all of the organic matter. So that includes all the carbon, all the nitrogen, and then all of the things that are much lower in concentration. If you want to get the exact amount of organic carbon and organic nitrogen, then you need to be able to measure those elements directly themselves. And that is part of a broad kind of suite of techniques that are referred to as elemental analysis. And they tend to be carried out in a single machine. So a single elemental analyzer will calculate not the percentage of all organic matter, but the exact concentration of organic carbon in that, well, of carbon in that sample. And then the concentration of nitrogen, perhaps the concentration of silica or sulfur. So they often are CNS analyzers. And that is a powerful tool because then you can get the exact amount of carbon. If you want to know the organic carbon component of that, you need to get rid of the inorganic carbon in that sample. And that's usually done through some sort of acid digestion. So you'll take your dried samples, you'll put them into an acid desiccator with some hydrochloric acid. That'll drive off all the inorganic carbon, leaving only the organic carbon. You submit those for, well, you rinse off the acid, don't send acidic samples to the EA. You get rid of all of that and it'll tell you how much organic carbon is in that sample, which is really useful and is an important first step to a lot of other analyses, especially the chemical analyses, the organic chemical analyses, because how much sediment you need to analyze is based on how much organic carbon is in that sample. Moving on to our laundry list of inorganic geochemical techniques is something we've already talked a little bit about when we talked about core scanning, and that is analyzing metals. So we've looked at carbon, nitrogen, sulfur as three elements, but there are ways to measure many, many of the elements on the periodic table in terms of their concentration in the sediment. And many of those elements are, as we know, metals and metalloids. And that means that it's really often quite interesting to understand how much there is in that sediment, whether that's because you're interested in contamination from metals or you're interested in changes in input from the terrestrial environment, which can be indicated by inputs of metals because they are in the geology. There are lots of different metals that might be of interest and a suite of different analyses kind of techniques. Generally, these are done by some sort of mass spectrometry, whether it's ICP-MS, whether it's AE. There are different ways that they can be analyzed, but in general, it's some sort of direct analysis of the concentration of those different metals, usually through ICP-MS.
And I think one thing I'd like to kind of interject here or like segue or aside would be thinking about, yes, you can measure the elements in the individual intervals, but for example, the elemental measurements of something like phosphorus would be of potentially limited value because, if you could measure, or well, you can measure phosphorus directly in the sediments, but if you believe those values were consistent through time, you wouldn't need to do diatom inferred total phosphorus concentration. So the idea being is some of these components within the sediments are actually potentially mobile. We touched on this a little bit in episode 3 when we're talking about cesium and how you know sometimes you can have a very focused cesium peak that would be very, very tight. But then in some kinds of sediments, you know, the cesium itself can diffuse and move around and sometimes see a much more diffuse peak. And so this is kind of like making a bit of a jump here, but just a bit of a throwback to what we're talking about in episode 2 in terms of the value of biomarkers. Sometimes you're going to need to use bioindicators to actually get measurements of these chemical components.
Sure. Yeah, most people are familiar with the fact that when the sediment water interface becomes anoxic, there's no oxygen there, then you can have internal loading of phosphorus as a common property of aquatic ecosystems.
Most people are aware of that.
Most people listening to this podcast are, Adam. We've been tracking our listeners. Okay, fair enough. Sometimes when the bottom of the lake loses its oxygen concentration, there's the potential for phosphorus to leave the sediment and enter back into the water column. It's a process that's called internal loading of phosphorus. And it's a really big problem for lake managers because it doesn't matter how much phosphorus abatement you have in the actual watershed. If there's all of this phosphorus locked in the sediment, then and the lake loses its oxygen concentration at the bottom, it becomes anoxic, and that material comes out of the lake, then that's a big problem. That phosphorus is coming out of the sediments, and it's not just coming out of the top half centimeter, it's coming out of the entire sediment profile. So phosphorus moves quite a lot in the sediments under different, in this case, oxygen conditions, and other elements like arsenic and antimony, which are in kind of in the same column of the periodic table, do the same sorts of things. So there is a lot of potential for different elements to move around the sediment. Some don't, some do. Really depends on that element and its chemistry under different conditions, where they may be related to the redox conditions. So the oxygen is often linked to that. Could be under different organic matter concentrations in the sediment. Things may move around a little more. pH levels. That's a, yeah, for sure. The idea that you can measure something in the sediment doesn't mean that it's always been in that interval, but from a methodological perspective, these are some of the techniques to do that. But that's a really important aside, agreed.
So continuing the segue into bioindicators, or the callback to bioindicators, really the difference, because there's a lot of overlap between a lot of the topics we're covering in these first couple of episodes, and really what our separation here is in bioindicators versus physical or chemical indicators is really methodological. So in the bioindicator one, we're talking about stuff that you looked at in a microscope, whereas today we're talking about stuff that you would use other kind of means. So even though something like pigments, for example, are very much a biomarker, you're not going to be looking at pigments or looking for pigments using the sediments directly through a microscope. You're going to use chemical techniques to isolate them from the sediments, with the most common one being high-performance liquid chromatography, which is where you use a series of solvents to pull out polar molecules of increasing molecular weight out of the sediments. This is something I've read a bit about, but I've never actually done myself. I've seen a lot of papers involving it. I think I may have seen a very old one while I was taking chemistry classes in undergraduate courses.
I remember being taken to see Dermot Antonides, HPLC, that he'd just gotten at the PALS meeting in 2008, maybe? Something like that. He'd just arrived there, I believe. So in Quebec City at Laval. But that's the only time I've ever seen one of these machines, to my knowledge anyway.
But yeah, so we're not really going into many of the techniques we're talking about today. Could be fleshed out into complete episodal discussions. We're just touching on everything, but that is just kind of covering our bases, because we did get a question, believe it or not, from someone who listened to our bioindicator episode asking, what about pigments? And the truth is, really, we're separating them methodologically rather than, lumping all biomarkers together.
Yeah. And although now I guess if we talked about NLKs, that would be a chemical method and some of those other things. So that one we threw in just because it made sense at the time.
We're just making up as we go.
Yeah, we have no idea what we're doing. But whether the pigments are methodologically, I don't think we could tell you anything more than what Adam's just said, and that probably stretched my knowledge as well. But they're really, really important because they can tell you about the different functional groups that are in the lake in terms of like sulfur-reducing bacteria, because some pigments are unique to certain taxa, and then others are going to be much more ubiquitous, things like chlorophyll, and the different chlorophyll molecules can tell you about overall production in the lake. So there's a lot of information that can be taken out of these different pigment analyses. And that's one of the ways in which we can estimate the overall production in the lake ecosystem. But there are others as well, such as spectral types of analyses.
Yeah. And so if you're using HPLC to measure pigments, you're basically looking at a certain amount of individual pigments such as chlorophyll, so that'd be a pigment used by higher plants, but you have other pigments that are used by various types of algae and down into bacteria. So you can also get an inferred measurement of the chlorophyll A using spectral methods, or, oh my goodness, go check my notes here. I want to say it right. Spectral radiometers, where you're actually looking at the amount of absorbance, or looking for the absorbance peak of a molecule like chlorophyll A in the sediment matrix itself, and allowing you to infer chlorophyll that way.
So it's known from the nature of the chlorophyll molecule what range of the electromagnetic spectrum it absorbs energy from, and that's between 650 and 700 nanometers or something in that range. And because of that, you know that if there's a change in the spectral reflectance or absorbance, which are kind of analogs of each other, in that interval, then you can use that to calculate and use a little bit of math to tell you how much chlorophyll there is in that interval. And one of the nice things about spectral techniques in comparison to the chromatography examples for pigments is that they're, at least the way that they're commonly done, they're non-destructive unlike HPLC, where the sediments are destroyed in their analysis. And then the other thing is that pigments, being a chromatography method, they are being analyzed individually, whereas the spectral reflectance method, it's been shown, incorporates not just the pigments themselves, but also their degradation products, which you would have to analyze individually in the HPLC method. So you get a little bit of information on not just the pigment concentration itself, but also the breakdown products. And I guess the other thing is that they're not really in the same way measuring concentration as you would from a HPLC type of pigment analysis. There's trade-offs associated with both techniques because of those different positives and negatives there.
And then just the last word for today on the spectral analyses would be, so in chlorophyll A, so you're looking at absorbance between 650 and 700 nanometers. You might sometimes see that referred to in the literature as visible reflectance spectroscopy. But more recently, you're starting to see, or there's some work being done to expand that range, and you might, into the infrareds, you might see VIR to near infrared spectroscopy, looking to infer trends in total organic carbon in the sediment matrix. And this one is quite interesting, because unlike the chlorophyll A, where you're actually measuring it to a known quantity or known absorbent peak of an individual molecule, for the total organic carbon models, you're actually looking at it compared to a calibration set. So you're not to reconstruct the total organic carbon that would have been in the water when that sediment was deposited. So you're a couple of steps removed, but it seems to be working. We can talk about that another day, but just kind of like capping spectral analyses off in for at least the tiny amount of it that Josh and I are familiar with.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, I think that in my mind covers the most commonly used inorganic geochemical techniques. There are undoubtedly others, and we'll probably have to delve back into this topic in a special episode or a separate episode on just that component, and maybe we'll dive a little deeper into those. But
again, pointing out how interconnected all these topics are, I just dropped the word calibration set with giving no reference at all to what that meant. And that's something that will come up when we're talking next time about environmental reconstructions.
Yeah, and also I just said that those are all inorganic geochemical techniques, but pigments are definitely not inorganic. So we've been crossing the boundary a little bit here in order to talk methodologically and just put them into any sort of order. Maybe we'll come back to organic at the end, organic chemical methods, and we'll move on to stable isotope techniques. And we're not going to talk a lot about this. I think we will need a whole episode on stable isotopes to really dive into the different isotopes. But the general idea of using stable isotopes being that, unlike in episode 3 when we talk about radioisotopes where there's a decay, stable isotopes are the same in the idea that they are elements that have different numbers of neutrons for the common number of protons. So the element is defined by the proton count. Different neutrons give them different masses in terms of the nucleus. But unlike radioisotopes, these are stable, or at least stable over the half-life of the Earth itself. And that means they don't decay. So in a carbon-14 radioisotope will eventually decay to a nitrogen isotope, whereas a carbon-13 isotope will not, or a carbon-12, which is the most common isotope of carbon. Carbons 12 and carbon-13 are considered stable because they don't undergo radioactive decay. So those are the type of elements that we are talking about in this case. And from a methodological perspective, that actually links, for some of them anyway, that you can find stable isotopes for lead and all of the different, almost all of the different elements of the periodic table can be analyzed for their stable isotope composition. Many of them are regularly done for paleo techniques of different kinds. But the ones that we often think of associated with paleo, other than some of the heavier metal elements like lead, are those of carbon. nitrogen and oxygen, which we've already talked a little bit about. And methodologically, it's actually not that much more challenging than the elemental analysis. The isotope ratio mass spectrometer, which is what actually measures the isotope ratios for these elements, is often an add-on to an elemental analyzer. So you'll put a sample on for percent carbon determination, percent nitrogen determination, and in addition, after it's gone through that workflow of the machine, it will be passed on to a stable isotope, an isotope ratio mass spectrometer, and that will measure the amount of carbon 13 to carbon 12 and nitrogen 15 to nitrogen 14. So those are the less common to most common isotopes of those elements.
And why would you want to do this, Josh?
Why would you want to do it all in one analysis? Because it's much easier, Adam.
I mean, I was kind of throwing you there. Like, why would you want to look at the difference between various stable isotopes?
Well, they can tell you about all sorts of different things that are going on. It really depends on the isotope you're talking about. But in general, the idea being that under different environmental conditions, there will be environmental, including biological in some cases, there will be different fractionation of the isotope. So the process which results in one isotope being at a certain ratio, a certain proportion to the others, depends on the environmental condition that they're occurring in. And you can look at the ratio of these and how they change in different media and how they change at different time periods in order to infer changes in the environment broadly. What those environments...
And just to jump in. Yeah, just jump in for a second. This is one of these topics that is kind of outside of my wheelhouse, but so I'm kind of chiming in for someone that is less familiar with this general idea. But the idea of fractionation, I think on the most simple level or the most straightforward example would be where you're talking about, let's say, stable isotopes of oxygen and the fractionation that would occur due to evaporation. So you would have lighter isotopes of oxygen would be preferential. So you have water molecules with the oxygen, the oxygen atom would be with the heavier, isotope.
Yeah. Oxygen 18 being the heavy isotope, yeah. Oxygen 16 being the common one, yep.
Yeah, so oxygen 16 would preferentially evaporate over time from the lake. So as time goes on, if evaporation is the primary, I guess, force acting on the lake compared to between two different lakes, the one with more evaporation occurring will have a greater concentration of the heavier oxygen isotope in within its stable oxygen isotopes that we'd find in the sediments.
Yeah, for sure. Chemistry is generally lazy, would be kind of a way to segue into this, isn't that from a chemical perspective, it may not seem that two neutrons, from our perspective, it may not seem that two neutrons is a big difference in weight, but for chemistry, it is. And that means that in general, when things need energy to evaporate or to move between media, the lighter isotope is often going to do that, leaving behind more of the heavier isotope. So if you've ever seen reconstructions of changes in global sea ice, for example, or global ice volume related to long-term climate. Those are based on oxygen 18, well, they're oxygen isotope reconstructions. And as you go into the ocean environment, there's going to be more evaporation of the light isotopes. Those isotopes are going to go up into the clouds, the lighter oxygen 16, leaving behind oxygen 18 in the marine environment. The clouds are going to move on to land. And right now, in our interglacial period, nothing really happens to them. They rain out on the land. They eventually come back to the ocean. No big deal. And then the volume doesn't change. When there's glaciers on the landscape, they evaporate. The clouds full of lighter oxygen 16 rain and snow onto the land, but it stays there as ice and doesn't come back to the ocean. And that means that the ocean becomes enriched in the heavier isotope over time. And you can use those changes in the oxygen 18 profile to say how the climate has changed in that reconstruction. But other isotopes, that's not the same process that's going to be driving them. For nitrogen, for example, often we're, from a paleo perspective, interested in changes in food web structure. So as you get more and more N15, the heavier of the nitrogen isotopes, those tend to accumulate as you move up the food chain. So if you look at a algae, they're going to have the same nitrogen 15-14 ratio is approximately the water that they're living in. But then as you look at zooplankton that are going to eat those algae, they're going to get rid of the nitrogen 14 and bring a little, and they'll have a little bit more N15 in their cells. And then a little planktivorous invertebrate might eat them, and then it'll have a little more N15, and then a fish will eat that and it'll have more N15, and then up and up the food chain until you get to the highest levels, and those are going to be quite enriched in the heavier isotope in that environment. And you can use that to track changes in that ecosystem.
And just to like go a little bit deeper in there, is you're not really, or I guess you are sometimes, but you're not always looking at the bulk sediment here. You're isolating particular molecules that you're interested in to look at changes over time. So for example, cellulose, looking at the changes in the carbon oxygen isotopes within the cellulose molecules over time. So you do a process to isolate the cellulose from the sediments, and then you would do your stable isotope techniques.
For sure. Yeah, or you pick out diatoms and look at the oxygen isotope composition in the silica that make up their valves, their cell walls. Or we talked about ostracods as being ostracods. A common oxygen 18 in their structure as well. So it can be on bulk sediment, or it can be on more specific parts of the actual sediment itself, or indicators.
Comes down to what you're trying to find out, really.
Yeah, and they'll tell you different things about the environment. Bulk sediment is going to be more integrative of the whole lake ecosystem, probably, whereas, you know, you might get different habitats for different ostracods versus diatoms. Lots of things that can be done with stable isotopes. We definitely need a whole episode on this now that we've talked about it for only a few minutes. I feel like we've just scratched the surface of this one.
That's really the purpose of what we're doing today. Again, we're just establishing the vocabulary that we can do callbacks for what basically bins these various techniques can fall into.
Okay, so moving on to, or maybe moving back to thinking about geochemical methods, we're going to talk about the organic molecules that can be analyzed in sediments very, very briefly. And we've talked about a couple of things already. We looked at, in previous episodes, we talked about alkanes and lignans and those other biomarkers.
Sterols and stanols.
Sterols and stanols, thank you. And also today we've already talked about pigments as a organic molecule. And those are all the ones that are linked to, if not specific biological groups, then to living organisms directly. But there are a whole class of organic molecules that are not necessarily linked specifically to biological organisms, but are present in the environment. We know there are organic molecules all over the natural world. And the way in which we often break these apart is to think about those that are found both in natural and sort of from an anthropogenic perspective, human-driven perspective. And then there are those that are entirely anthropogenic. There are no natural sources of these organic molecules. And that's a really important distinction, because if you're trying to piece together the history of that environment, knowing that there is no natural source of this chemical gives you an indication that if you find it, we know that there is some influence of humans historically in that location, even if it's from an atmospheric kind of global perspective, we know that it is from human activities. Whereas if we have some of these molecules that are natural as well, there may be processes completely independent of humans that result in their being in that location. And that's an important distinction. From a perspective of what these molecules are, the natural compounds we're often thinking about and the most commonly found in paleo studies are the polycyclic aromatic compounds broadly, or PAHs. It used to be more common to call them PAHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, but PAC is a more catch-all term because it incorporates organic molecules that aren't true hydrocarbons, which just have hydrogen and carbon, such as the sulfur-containing dibenzothiophenes, basically, in the kind of analyses that we find. And those are molecules that have natural sources. So completely independent of humans, you could go to a place where there's a natural oil seep or where biomass organic molecules are being combusted, burned, you're going to get PAHs in that location. Every time you throw a steak on the grill, you're creating PACs in the environment. They're ubiquitous in the
delicious.
Yeah, they're delicious as well. Exactly. And that's just part of the way in which organic chemistry works. So there are lots and lots of sources of PACs in the environment, including some that are, if not entirely by human, enhanced by human activity. So oil and gas operations where we're burning carbon is going to result in PACs, or where we are extracting these resources, there can be the potential for contamination that results in PACs entering in the environment. And the reason we care is that some of these compounds are known to be toxic, carcinogens or mutagens and that sort of thing, and others perhaps aren't that that case. So that is a large class of group of compounds.
Yeah. And even if, you know, when you're dealing with some of these that are naturally occurring, what you'll be looking for often is a potential spike in their concentration in the sediments that would coincide with oil and gas development or, you know, refinery operations or something like that.
Yeah. Car emissions, vehicle emissions from combustion of internal combustion engines. Yeah, for sure. You find PACs absolutely everywhere. But they can be used for telling you about other processes that aren't humans either. Forest fires are a massive source of PACs in the environment because of all the biomass that's being burned. And you can use them in addition to, for say, charcoal to track some such activities.
Yeah, so having two independently measured proxies that are telling you a little bit about the same thing is a fairly useful tool for reinforcing whatever you're seeing.
Yeah, and it's such a, when I say PAC, it's a massive class of organic compounds. They're basically just fused benzene rings in different combinations, from the lightest, low molecular weight things like naphthalene up to massive, large 5-6 ring compounds. Not as common, but they do exist. So they themselves, the different PAC compounds are going, or PA compounds, I guess, are going to tell you about different processes occurring. So there's a ton of chemistry related to PACs that can be really, really useful in a paleo setting.
And then going from there, continuing from there. So yeah. going from ones that are also, that are naturally occurring, there's a large classes of organic chemicals out there that are not naturally occurring and directly related to human activities. So we're talking about things like organochlorine pesticides and PCBs,
polychlorinated biphenyls, any organic molecule that humans have created for their purposes. Often one of the things we want about them is them not to break down very quickly because we've made them for a particular purpose. They often are expensive to make and distribute and that kind of thing. So we don't want them to break down so they can be persistent in the environment. So we often class these as persistent organic pollutants as a big group of compounds. And things like PCBs, or you may have heard of DDT, which is a pesticide, are all examples of molecules that don't exist in nature. They've been created in human laboratories and human petrochemical plants for a specific purpose. And once applied to the environment, they can be persistent for many, many years. So PCBs haven't been released in Canadian locations for a long time now, but we still find them, you know, almost ubiquitously in the sediments of the vast majority of lakes in Canada, because of their long history of use and broad use, and then also because of how persistent they are in the environment. And there are others that could be falling into these category, things like perfluorinated acids as a broad group, brominated flame retardants, which sounds like a strange term, but they're found in, maybe not anymore, but not long ago, they were found in, you know, every household. Things to stop your consumer products from catching on fire, like your couch catching on fire.
Your mattress.
Yeah, absolutely. So anytime those get thrown into the landfill or go up in a fire, in a house fire, for example, those compounds are being released to the environment and can be persistent for a long time period there.
Okay. So I think we're going to wrap it up there. So that's the end of our organic chemical methods section within our physical chemical indicators episode. We covered a lot of ground really, really quickly, and in some cases probably did a terrible job, let us know. And most of these topics will eventually be revisited in more detail going forward.
Yeah, maybe bringing in experts on some of them to talk about them.
That would be great.
If you're an expert in one of these methods and yeah, you'd like to join as a guest on the podcast, let us know. We would be happy to have you.
Because again, there are lots and lots of techniques out there, and absolutely nobody is an expert in everything. Everyone has their specialties. And so even though, you know, you'll come across when you're, you know, reading about particular studies, a lot of these things, it's easy to know what they are in a very general sense without having any real clue of how they work.
Yeah, and some of them are just complicated topics. The chemistry of, you know, organic molecules is whole degrees just to be able to talk about that. So summarizing them in a few minutes is never going to do the full topic justice, and gives us a chance to revisit them in the future because they are some really interesting examples. And then maybe we'll dive into, when we talk about them individually, a couple of really cool studies that have analyzed them and some of the things they found from that analysis.
Okay. So we're going to call it quits for now. But if you want to get in contact with us, again, questions are absolutely great. You can send them to us via email at coreideaspodcast@gmail.com. You can get in touch with us directly on Twitter, and that's where you'll get the fastest response from us, because we're not really checking the email address every single second of the day, but we have phones with Twitter on them. That is
Core Ideas Paleo, P-A-L-E-O, on Twitter. So send us a message and we'll be happy to hear from you.
Okay. And then one last thing is also we have our website. We basically are using as a archive of all our episodes so far. And there's a some show notes to accompany summaries if you want to, well, we're not going to have a whole lot of details about what we covered today, but just going forward, coreideas.ajezioriski.ca is our website. And
there's funny memes on there sometimes. We have funny memes. Yes. We think they're funny anyway.
We think they're funny, and that's really all that matters.
That's why we're here. Just talking to each other, mostly. But we've actually been really quite pleased with all of the feedback. So thanks for listening. Continue if you wish, and we look forward to the next few episodes. I guess the last thing we can say is that in our general overview, a little bit more methodologically driven episodes, we only have one more, I think, that we have planned, right?
Yeah. So teaser for next time, we're going to be looking at environmental reconstruction. So we've referred to them in a couple different ways, but basically looking at, you know, for example, mentioned today, phosphorus. If you can't measure the phosphorus directly in the sediments, how could you get about inferring what phosphorus conditions used to be like over the last couple hundred years, if not longer, in a lake? And that will be the kind of environmental reconstruction we'll be talking about next time. So once again, thanks for listening, and we hope to see you soon again next time.
Bye. Thanks.